This is Audible.
Angel Falls, Texas, The Traveler, The Origin. Written by J.C. Hulsey. Narrated by Chaz Allen. Chapter 1. March 12, 1869. Angel Falls was named for the daughter of the town founder, who insisted that she had fallen from heaven. She was born as they crossed the river just below the small waterfalls, a little north of town, but she didn't live up to her namesake, as she was one of the most sought-after girls in town, because she had a habit of not being able to say no to the adventurous young men who came calling. Wasn't long until she was sent to live with her aunt in the big city. Angel Falls was a fairly quiet town with very little trouble, partly because of the sheriff, a brute of a man with a barrel chest and short legs, which at a glance made him look deformed. He ruled with an iron fist and was quick on the trigger, but all in all, he was a fairly decent lawman. Chapter 2. Angel Falls has been my home for a little over 17 years. I was born on June 2, 1852, in a little house on the outskirts of town to Mr. and Mrs. Jeremiah Jenkins. They named me Jedediah Isaiah. Pa owned the livery stable and blacksmith shop in town. He was just a blacksmith until I turned 10, when he said I was old enough to take care of the chores around the farm, so he opened the livery stable as well. Pa was a big, burly Irishman with shoulder-length, curly, red, almost bright orange hair. He was tall, standing 6'5", and weighed about 285 pounds. His arms were the size of small tree trunks, and he had not an ounce of fat since he swung the hammer and pumped the bellows, day in and day out. I usually went to the livery stable each day after I ate lunch and finished the chores at home. Hank Crenshaw ran the livery stable after dark, and slept in the tack room beside the horse stalls. Pa would try to be home before 7 each day. We both worked really hard to take care of the 60-acre farm, livery stable, and blacksmith shop. We were one of the first families to have a windmill, and because of that, one of the first houses to have running water. Pa, being the blacksmith, designed and built it himself. We went every Sunday to the little white Baptist church with the tall steeple over on the hill east of town. Pa and me, we'd been attending regular ever since Ma left. It was in that little church that I discovered my Savior, and how much he loved me, and how much I wanted to do what was right in his eyes. I was baptized in Fountain Creek, the little stream just below the falls. Chapter 3. On my 15th birthday, Pa gave me an Appaloosa horse with the most beautiful leopard-spotted coat. I named her Sugar because she loved to eat sugar. He had traded her for some Arapaho Indians who were passing by our farm on their way back to the reservation. That was almost 3 years ago. She's the best friend I ever had, other than my Ma, and then my Pa, after Ma ran off with that slick-talking drummer when I was almost 11. What she saw in that bum with greasy, slick back hair wearing a bowler and a string tie and button-down shoes is beyond me. The last thing I remember about Ma is seeing the back of her favorite blue calico dress with the pots and pans rattling on the back of the peddler's wagon as she disappeared beyond my view. Since then, it's just been me and Pa, and we've been doing great. Sugar and me go riding every chance we get. We would race through the vast flats of dull, light green grass, sparse, dull, huge species of mesquite, and cactus flashing by. Passing woods of light and tender trees was sometimes so invigorating, I just wanted to keep going with nowhere in mind, just wandering, me and Sugar. Then I would think of Pa, and how hard he'd worked to be my Ma and Pa since she left, teaching me about the outside chores as well as those inside the house. He never told me where he learned to cook, but his breakfast of salt pork and pan bread was beyond compare. He had learned to make it several different ways. Sometimes he made it with just flour and water, mixing it up good and pouring it into the skillet after frying up the salt pork. When it got brown on one side, he would flip it over and repeat on the other side. Then he would cover it and let it bake a few minutes more. Sometimes he'd add a little cornmeal, and he had even taken to adding some beef or bacon crumpled up in it. Sometimes he would make some extra. We could eat it at the livery stable that day for dinner. When done with my chores, I'd spend almost all my spare time out behind the barn practicing with my pistol. Pa had assured me that most fast guns were not sharpshooters. It was usually the second shot that was the kill shot. The first shot almost always went wild. He said, "Always shoot straight and true, even if you're a bit slower. Even a quarter or a half a second, or just the blink of your eye, could mean the difference between living and dying." Chapter 4. One day I went to the livery stable a little early because Pa wanted me to deliver a special tool that he had spent 2 days repairing for one of the elderly customers who didn't get to town very often. I tied Sugar to the back door of the stable and started in. A big, almost as big as Pa, grotesque-looking man with a dark red furrowed scar that ran from just above his right eye down along his jaw and disappeared into a sweat-stained collar, came riding up on a worn-out bay mare whose coat was slick with lather. We'd seen a lot of men return from the war with scars, beaten down and mean, but none compared to this fellow, who sent a cold chill down to the tips of my toes. He had a meanness oozing out from all over him like water on a slicker on a rainy day. His clothes reeked with the sick, sweaty, greasy smell that caused my stomach to tighten and come mighty close to losing that breakfast of salt pork and pan bread that Pa had fixed. As he glanced my way, I quickly averted my eyes and looked down the lonely, dusty road from where he had come. The sky had turned purplish, the wind stilled, and the dog stopped barking like a storm was in the making. When the man spoke, it sounded like gravel rattling in a wooden bucket. "Needs his right shoe tightened and be ready to ride in a half an hour," he said. "This horse ain't going no place without proper rest. At least 3 days, he's all rode out. Be a miracle if he makes it through the night," replied my Pa. "Did I ask for your opinion or advice? Don't think I did," the man sneered. Pa was a real easy-going man, but he had this habit of always speaking his mind and saying exactly what he was feeling. As I look back, I wish Pa had been different that day and just not said anything. Well, I'm telling you that any man that treats an animal the way you've treated this horse should be whipped, exclaimed my Pa. "You figure on doing that little job yourself, do you?" quipped the man. "Just might be I will." As Pa sidestepped to the left, Ugly threw a sledgehammer fist at Pa's head, just missing it by a tad. Pa landed a haymaker to Ugly's right temple, causing him to stagger back into the work table next to the forge. As he stumbled, he grabbed a hammer lying there, and with a roundhouse swing, he connected with Pa's head, knocking him on his back on the dusty stable floor. Ugly jumped on top, straddling him, and continued to swing blow after blow into Pa's face. I stood frozen in the dusty stable floor, unable to move as time seemed to crawl. Then, just as suddenly, I realized that if I didn't do something, Pa was going to die. What I didn't realize was that Pa was already dead. I took my pistol from the holster and shouted for the man to stop. He glared up at me and laughed a belly laugh as he shouted, "Yeah, I'll stop, and when I do, you're next." The menacing scar that jagged along his right jaw puckered as he smirked at me and gave off a sinister R when he screamed. His eyes turned black with rage as he lunged up and towards me. Confusion clouded the man's expression as the bullet entered just above his left eye, and then his gaze went blank as he dropped the hammer of death and slumped to the stable floor. I stood and stared in awe at what I had done. I'd just taken another man's life, and even though I was quivering on the outside, I felt extremely calm on the inside. Somehow I knew that God would understand that I didn't have a choice in the matter. The man had just killed my Pa and had every intention of making me his next victim. He most certainly would have killed me if I hadn't reacted the way I did. I felt the forgiveness of a loving and understanding God fill me with sweet calmness. Just then, Henry Plank, the telegraph operator from next door, came running in, demanding to know what had happened. I tried to explain, but I was breathing too hard for him to understand. He looked first at my Pa, then at the dead man, and said, "Son, you better head for the hills, because the man you just killed is the sheriff's baby brother, and he was quite partial to him." I looked at Pa's bloody face and felt myself grow calm on the inside. "Not sorry I killed him. He killed my Pa," I said. "And go make no never mind of the sheriff. You go shoot first, ask questions later," exclaimed Plank. "I'll see to your Pa. You better go now." Sugar was still saddled back of the livery where I was going to deliver something to a customer later that morning. I reloaded the one shot that I had used and slid my pistol slowly back into the holster. I grabbed my jacket, pulled my Stetson low on my head, and checked my saddlebags, which held the salt pork and pan bread Pa and me were going to have for lunch. I checked my canteen, tightened the cinch on Sugar's saddle, nodded to Mr. Plank, and slid easily into the saddle. I took the south road out of town and noticed the bank, general store, and dressmaker's shop on the right. On the left was the chuck wagon, combination saloon and eating house. Directly across from it was the stagecoach station. The last thing I noticed as I passed the final building of the town I had grown up in was the little cottonwood tree standing sentinel over the town, looking as lost and lonely as I was feeling about then. A shiver ran through my body and sadness filled my heart as I thought of me and Pa sitting at the table just this morning. I pulled my hat down tighter, hunched up my shoulders, hunkered down in the saddle, kicked Sugar in the ribs, and took off at a gallop. As I came to the boundary of our small town, I tasted a salty tear as it slid down my face, and I felt a hurting in my chest as I left Pa and a place I had counted as a friend. Chapter 5. I rode until almost dusk, when the light started fading and the sun was setting in the northwest. I slowed Sugar to a walk. I surveyed the area for a place to bed down. Off to the right was a grove of cedar trees and what looked like a place that could have some water. Looked like the perfect spot to camp. So I clicked to Sugar, and we angled toward it. The cedar made sort of a fort with a tiny clearing in the middle where there was a little mossy banked pond. The moonlight caused an orange hue across the water, and there were frogs croaking their songs. I dismounted and led Sugar to the edge of the water. She drank deeply, then huffed a little. I knelt down after Sugar drank, then filled my hand with water and lifted it to my lips. It was cool and sweet to the taste, so I knelt further down and immersed my face, washing away the dirt from the trail and drinking deeply. That pond must have been fed by an underground stream, because as I looked around, I couldn't see how the water had gotten there. I raised my knees to look around. There was plenty of kindling to build a fire, but I decided not to, because I couldn't be sure if the sheriff and a posse were following or not. I rose, loosened the cinch on Sugar's saddle, and reached for my saddlebags, where I had something to eat. I hobbled Sugar over to the edge, where there was plenty of fresh green grass. She began munching and seemed content, oblivious as to the trouble we were in. As I ate, I began remembering things about my Pa and the livery stable. When I left the farm that morning, I wasn't expecting to travel any further than a customer's house right outside town, so I hadn't packed any gear other than my saddlebags with something to eat for lunch and my canteen, which was about half full. I didn't pack a slicker or a bedroll. It felt like it was going to be a cool night, so I was really glad I grabbed my jacket when I left. All I had were the clothes on my back. That would be all right for tonight, because I could use my saddle blanket for cover if it got too cool. As I looked up at the star-filled night sky, I wondered about the consequences that had brought me to this place, and my mind began racing, it seemed, 90 miles an hour, remembering Pa. Chapter 6. Running a livery stable gave Pa the opportunity to have dealings with almost every cowboy, trader, gambler, drifter, veterans, north and south, and even outlaws, any man who rode a horse or drove a wagon. That's how I got my saddle and my pistol, a Remington new model army revolver with an 8-inch barrel. It had been a .44 caliber cap and ball, but it had been converted to .46 caliber metallic cartridges. The barrel was gunmetal gray with mammoth ivory grips and was special ordered from Alaska. I was especially proud because of the low serial number stamped on it. Pa had traded it from a Yankee captain on his way back to the orchards of apple trees that he hadn't seen for 3 long years. Pa always treated every man fair and square and traded that Yankee captain an exceptionally good roan horse and saddle with all the gear, as the man's horse had come up lame quite a few miles out of town and he had to shoot him. He sure hated leaving his saddle and all his gear, but he couldn't carry it very far, as he only had one arm. "Lost it in the Battle of Fort Blakely in southern Alabama. Remember it well, April 9th, 1865, Palm Sunday, 5 o'clock p.m., the man had said. "War had been over almost 2 hours. 700 miles to the northeast, General Lee had surrendered to General Grant at Appomattox, Virginia. But that didn't change anything where we were, because we didn't know it until later that the war was officially over. Ironic, ain't it? 3 years without so much as a scratch. And then, in the last few moments of the fighting, it happened. Could have been worse, I reckon. Yep, mighty lucky. Least I can still pick apples with one good hand. He was very gracious in his dealings with Pa, and said thank you probably 3 or 4 times. Said he considered his luck to still be holding when he ran into Pa. He halted at the edge of town, turned and waved, then continued on his way to those apple trees. I needed another holster because this one had a flap that all the soldiers had on their holsters. I talked to Mr. Salinger, the owner of the mercantile, into trading me a holster that he'd gotten from Mr. Hollister, the undertaker, when a bank robber got killed trying to rob the bank. Mr. Hollister sold it to Mr. Salinger to pay for the coffin, and Mr. Salinger said, well, might as well let me have it because there wasn't that many people wanting a left-handed holster. My saddle was traded from a down-on-his-luck Mexican caballero by the name of Manuel Rodriguez. He'd worked for one of the oldest and largest rancheros in Mexico and was running from the federales for, as he put it in his broken English, a big mistook. The saddle was a gaucho ranch saddle and had lots of silver inlay engraving. Pa traded him a smaller saddle with gear and a few American dollars, as all he had was pesos. He waved as he rode off with a big grin on his face. Well, I was also grinning because Pa had said that the next saddle he traded for was going to belong to me, and I could hardly wait to try it on Sugar. Chapter 7. Woke the next morning just as the sun peeked over the horizon, casting a bright yellowish glow across the little pond where the frogs were still singing their mournful-sounding song. Think they must have croaked all night long. As I saddled Sugar, I had this tight feeling in my gut. Could just be hunger, or could be I was feeling a little scared, or could be both. What was I going to do now? Just 17 years old, and here I was, running from the law. I finished the cold salt pork and pan bread that was left from yesterday and found that hunger wasn't the only tight feeling I had in my gut. Filled my canteen and saddled Sugar, feeling thankful and proud of what I did have and sorry for what I didn't and was leaving behind. Lifted myself into the saddle and headed south along the edge of the forest. After nearly 3 hours, I saw a ramshackled farm in the distance. Was I going to just ride on by or go up to the front door and ask for something to put in my growling stomach? My stomach decided for me, so I rode on to the front. A brisk breeze whipped through the yard around the corner of the corral, bringing with it the scent of horse manure, reminding me of a livery stable, and causing my chest to ache with the thought of Pa standing at the doorway, welcoming a stranger to bring his mountain side. As I surveyed the place, I noticed it was more a cabin than a house. Built of both rock and hand-hewn wood planks, it had a main room and 2 other rooms that had been added to it. It looked like it 2 separate times. It had been a while since the walls were whitewashed, and there was a broken-down picket fence in the front yard. The roof was in need of a few shingles, and the big 2-story barn, which was set off to the left, was also in need of repair. 2 broken brindle mares were in the corral, which had some of the fence boards missing. Beside the corral sat a dilapidated light buckboard that had seen better days. A light buckboard could be pulled by either 1 or 2 horses. It was a real run-down-looking place. I pushed my hat up from my face, stepped down from the saddle. Inside of the house, a man stepped out with a rifle and said, "Stand right where you are. Explain what you're doing here, what you want." As I turned to face him, I saw a middle-aged man, probably 40 or 50 years old and 185 pounds, with a sunburned face and arms and wearing a pair of faded, striped overalls with a slouched hat. The rifle was a Henry 45 caliber repeater, just like they used in the war. "Just looking to trade a little work for something to eat, maybe a place to bed down for the night." "How old might you be?" he asked. I answered, "Going on 18 in a few months, which means I'm a growing lad who can work really hard for a little something to put in my belly." "Undo your sidearm, step forward away from it. We'll talk about it. What's a young boy like you doing riding alone way out here? You in some kind of trouble, are you?" "You could say that. Depends on how you look at things. I don't figure I did anything wrong, but there are some folks who feel otherwise." As I unbuckled my gun belt and let it fall to the ground, I asked, "Is that better? My name's Jedediah Jenkins, and I sure would like to be jawing around some food instead of these here words." The man laughed as he slid his rifle under his arm, removed his hat, wiped his mostly bald head with his bandana, and said, "Name's Orville Brewster. Pick up your gun, come on into the cabin, and sit. Maybe we can stir up something for a hungry young man." Placed the rifle at the side of the door as we walked in, then said with a grin, "You never know when you might need it. I always got some beans on the stove ready to eat with some cold Johnny cakes. Also cool milk to drink if you're a mind to drink goat's milk. Some folks swear by it, others swear at it, because they say it smells funny. Anyway, this'll be the last of it, because she's run off just yesterday morning. Kind of work you figure you can do. I'll say this for you, you're a stout-looking young fellow." I took after my pa with my looks. I weighed in at roughly 170 pounds, stood almost 6 feet tall, and had pa's trademark red hair. Kids in school and folks in town used to call me Red Junior, but I preferred Jed. "Well, I reckon I can do just about anything you'd need done. Point in the direction you want me to go." "Well, all right, let's eat," he said, "and then we'll discuss it." He heaped 2 tin plates with beans, then poured milk into 2 tin cups and placed them on a homemade wooden table alongside a platter of Johnny cakes. "Sit and dig in before the beans get cold," he said. "As you probably noticed, when you rode up, place needs a lot of repair. Kind of got run down while I was off fighting rebs up north trying to keep 'em from taking over the country. Not only did the place get run down, but when I got back, my wife was nowhere around." Then he continued on and said, "Reckon I can't fault her for leaving the way she did, what with trying to scratch out a living on a scrub farm and having a man who thought going off and fighting for his convictions was more important than staying home and fighting for his wife and house and land. But I always did feel that no man should own another human being. Kind of lost my desire to fix the place up by myself. Guess you might say I've been feeling kind of sorry for myself and mighty lonesome, too. About ready to shuck it all and sell out to that ornery neighbor of mine who wanted my land ever since we come here in 54. So I'm glad you showed up when you did. Been waiting for somebody to jaw with for a spell now. Here I am running my mouth and not letting you talk. How about that trouble you said you might be in? Anything I can do to help?" I looked at him and thought to myself, should I trust him? Working in the livery stable with Pa had given me pretty good instinct about people, and I had a good feeling about him, and proceeded to tell him how things happened and why I was on the run. He said to me, "Sounds like you drew the short straw in this deal, but you did the right thing to hightail it out of there. That fellow must have learned how to be mean from his older brother, the one you said was the sheriff." As he cleared the table after we finished eating, he said, "Why don't you go put your horse in the barn, then come back and bed down that room off to your right. Supposed to be a room for our baby. That didn't work out. Wife miscarried in the 7th month. Been about your age if he'd have lived. Wife never was the same after that." I told him I'd be right back, and then I went to put sugar in the barn. I counted my blessings that I had stopped at a place with a man who, although he looked absolutely nothing at all like my pa, had a fatherly aura about him that gave me a really good feeling. I might consider him a friend some day. And believe you me, I could really use a friend about now. Sounded like Orville Brewster could use a friend, too. I unsaddled Sugar, guided her into a stall, scooped some oats from a brown burlap bag sitting over on the bench, gave her a good brushing and told her good night, and turned to go back inside. Before I got to the front door, I stopped, glanced up into the dark, cloudy sky with just a yellow moon smiling down at me, and I bowed my head and told the Lord how much I appreciated him watching over me and guiding me to Mr. Orville Brewster's house. Mr. Brewster was banking on the fire in the fireplace when I returned, and I said, "Good night, Mr. Brewster," and headed for the room where he said I could sleep. He called out and said, "You can call me Orville." Chapter 8. After a restless night, I woke to the smell of coffee and bacon. I'll tell you, there is nothing smells better than fresh brewed coffee when you wake up in the morning. I slipped into my blue dungarees, pulled on my blue chambray shirt and my boots, and then trotted outside to take care of business, just as dawn gradually spilled over the land and turned the pewter sky into a cloudless, clear blue. I hurried right back in, because there was a slight chill in the South Texas morning air, and a little bit of frost on the ground. Orville was just pouring dark, thick coffee into a battered tin cup when I came through the door, and he said I should sit and eat. Sat on the far side of the homemade wooden table, bowed my head, said a little prayer of thanks for the food and the company of a man like Orville, dug into the bacon, eggs, and pan gravy. The coffee was just as good as it smelled, even though it was a little thick. As I soaked a piece of hardtack in the gravy left on the plate, Orville straddled the old wooden chair, propped his hairy arms across the back, and asked what I planned on doing today. He told me that he'd be proud if I could see myself clear to stay on with him a while and help get the place back in shape. Couldn't pay much, but I would have a roof over my head and something to eat every day. Maybe not 3 square, but enough to get by. Then he said, "To be completely honest, I'm mighty lonesome, and I can see you might need some company, too. Plus, you're about the same age as my boy would have been." I told him I'd be proud to stay and help him. The long, dry days turned into months, and the weather turned cooler. The place began to shape up, look like something any man could be proud of. Chapter 9. On September 2nd, we began working before sunup, hauling hay from the field and storing it in the barn loft. Even though Orville had no cattle, he said there wasn't any reason to let the hay go to waste. I was in the loft forking hay to the back wall while Orville tossed it up to me. We had become mighty close during the months that I had been here. Even though he was not anything like Pa, he reminded me of him in so many ways. We talked all the time, him telling me about his time in the Calvary, and me telling him about Penelope and how much I missed my Pa. We each shared our dreams and what we wanted to do the rest of our lives. Around 10 o'clock that morning, a man rode into the yard and hollered for Mr. Orville Brewster to show his face. Orville told me to stay put, as this was that ornery neighbor he was telling me about, and there ain't no telling what he might do. It looked like the perfect spot to camp, so neither one of us had our weapons with us. I reckon things had been so peaceful while we worked that we had kind of gotten to feeling safe and weren't expecting no trouble at all. Orville stepped out of the barn, walked over to where his neighbor, Mr. Sheffield, was looking down from his mount, kind of like a king sitting on a throne. "Looks like you got my place fixed up real nice," the man said. "Now I'm going to expect you to move on by the end of the week." "What are you talking about? This here's my place," said Orville. "Has been for almost 15 years. You can't just waltz in here and take something that belongs to somebody else." "While you were off fighting that stupid war, you got delinquent on your taxes, and an auction was held in town for this place, and guess who won that auction?" Sheffield said. "I give you to the end of the week, and me and my boys will be coming to claim this here property." A slight resemblance of someone came to mind, as he had the same mannerisms of the sheriff back in town. He was sitting astride his mount with a haughty way of looking down his nose at the person he was conversing with, like he owned or controlled the world and everybody in it. Suddenly, I felt her bitterness begin to build, and I had to ask God for help in quelling this awful feeling that was taking root in me. I could sense the hurt that Orville was feeling. If I'd have had my pistol, I would have shot that man right on the spot. As I think back on that day, I guess the good Lord had his hand on me and Orville, as we had left our weapons in the house. Sheffield jerked his horse around, spurred him, then galloped off out of the yard and down the road. Orville was just standing there with a surprised look on his face. "Well, boy, reckon we fixed up the place for somebody else to enjoy. I told you before, he's wanted this place ever since me and my wife first settled here. Well, I reckon he got it." "Where was it you were headed to when you got here?" Orville asked. "If you don't mind, kind of like to be your traveling partner and tag along with you." I climbed down out of the loft, stood beside Orville, placed my arm on his shoulders as we watched the dust from Sheffield's horse disappear. Chapter 10. The following morning we were packed and ready to ride. Neither of Orville's brindle mares were very good horses, and they weren't broke for the saddle, so he hooked them up to the old buckboard in which he had loaded all his items that he wanted to take with him. Big horse ranch called Val Verde Ranchos, about 175 miles to the south, owned by a Mexican named Joaquin Marietta, who claims he inherited the land from his Spanish ancestors. Maybe I can talk him into trading one of his horses for my two. Having worked in Pa's livery stable since I was a little lad gave me a pretty good instinct about horse flesh. If Orville could give his horses away, he'd be one lucky fella. In any event, we headed south for that horse ranch. When we got about 150 yards out, Orville pulled up on the reins, turned in the seat, then took a really long look, wiped a tear from his eye, and said, "Good riddance. Been nothing but a heartache since I first seen you." Turned back, grinned at me, and said, "Burn the place down just for meanness, but he's probably going to want to do that for himself, because he only wants the land. Let's ride." Chapter 11. All we heard for the next few miles was the noise of the wagon wheels and the clip-clopping of the horses' hooves on the hard-packed earth. The trip was long, dry, dusty, and as we passed vast flats of scrub grass, dull-hued spaces of mesquite, cacti, and cedar trees off in the distance. I'd often heard about the dry Texas plains, but this was the first I had experienced them. We traveled for about 4 hours when Orville suggested we stop and eat something. As a growing boy, I had no complaints when it came to eating. We hobbled the horses and started a small fire with the kindling we found close by. Orville always had a pot of beans heating on the stove back home, and he simply picked up the pot and brought it along. This time he also had a pot of potatoes, which made it that much better. He hung them over the flames and gathered up the tin plates and forks that he had stowed in the wagon. He also set a pot of coffee to one side of the fire to keep it hot. When the meal was warm enough, we piled a heap of both beans and taters on a plate, grabbed a cup of coffee, sat down to enjoy a very much appreciated meal. Probably 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when a warm breeze swept down from the north across the dry grass, bringing with it the sweet scent of rain. Gray clouds gathered in the northwest, rolling one on top of the other and bumping out the slight rumbling sound of thunder. The farmers and ranchers would welcome the rain, but as for me, I didn't want to get caught out in a thunderstorm without a slicker. Explained what I was feeling to Orville, and he said, "Don't worry, I know a place close by that we can hunker down till this rain blows over. It's just over that little rise off to the east a bit." When we arrived, there was an outcropping of rocks and a large clump of trees, covered with grapevines so thick there wasn't any way to get inside. "We'll have to chop a trail into there, but I guarantee it'll keep us dry as any man-made structure. And it just so happens I brought my trusty sword with me when I packed the wagon, so we can open a doorway," Orville said. Having been a sergeant in the Union Army, he still had his model 1840 non-commissioned officer's sword. The sword had a 31-inch blade, a cast brass hilt resembling the more expensive wire-wrapped leather grips, a leather scabbard rather than steel, and was used by cavalry troops and officers. As Orville chopped, I tossed the limbs and vines out of the way, and pretty soon we had a path large enough for the horses and us. Just as we got the two brindles unhitched, the first raindrops began pelting down. We hurried to the center where Orville kept chopping until there was a big enough hole for us to settle down. It's almost pitch dark because of the grapevines obscuring the sunlight. We built a small fire, hunkered down with a cup of coffee to wait out the storm. And as we waited, I felt a little drowsy, so I laid back, closed my eyes, and before the next thunderclap, I was fast asleep. I dreamed of someone very special in my life beside my pa. She was about the same age as me, and we hung around together with Jeremy Johansson, who was also the same age. The Three Musketeers, we used to call ourselves. She had turned into the most beautiful thing I had ever laid eyes on. Probably 5'5", strawberry blonde hair, ruby red lips, the clearest pale blue eyes you ever looked into, and the pert little turned-up nose. 3 days before I left town, she had let me taste her lips, and they were so soft and sweet I thought that I had died and gone to heaven. Her name was Penelope Ann Coe, and I loved her and planned on marrying her some day. I reckon that since I was out of the picture, Jeremy would step in. As Penelope always said, she couldn't decide which one of us she liked the most. Just as we were fixing to kiss again, I woke up to a still quietness and knew the storm had passed us by. Orville was snoring so loud I didn't know how I slept through all that thunder plus his snoring. I woke him and suggested that we head out, as we had a ways to go to reach that rancheros and trade for a horse. Chapter 12. We traveled until midnight, headed down into a little washed-out arroyo, long absent of any moisture at all. I unsaddled Sugar, placed my saddle upwind of the horses because I'd made the mistake of camping downwind one time when Sugar decided to have a bad case of diarrhea, and I do not want to go through that again. Orville returned with some sticks and twigs and built a small campfire, just enough to heat a pot of coffee. We both enjoyed a cup and then bedded down for the night. As I studied the stars, a pale slice of moonlight illuminated the side of the arroyo with a yellowish tint. I said a little prayer of thanks to the Lord for watching over Orville and me. The heat was unbearable, and I was so uncomfortable that I got up and walked out a ways from the camp where there was the slightest northeast breeze blowing across the prairie. I decided that since it was cooler here than in the arroyo, I would get my bedroll and sleep under the starry nighttime sky. Well, I slept pretty well for what was left of the night, seeing as how it was after midnight when we stopped. When I woke up, I rolled my bedroll and headed back down into the arroyo, where Orville had some breakfast frying in the skillet. Bacon and beans and thick hot coffee. Couldn't get much better than that. After we ate, we sat and jawed a while about what kind of horse Orville wanted. He said even though he had been in the cavalry while in the army, they didn't let him have a horse because he was a mess sergeant. He said he was partial to Morgan horses because his captain had a big, beautiful brown Morgan. It was about the finest horse he'd ever seen. Or I might like a big blue roan brindle stallion, but I understand they're pretty rare because of the way their coats change color every year. Maybe I'll get lucky, though. God knows. About time my luck changed. Well, I said, we need to get going. We won't get there. The country seemed to get drier. The vegetation was very sparse. Just a few scrub-brush trees and a couple of cactus were all we saw for miles, with loads and loads of throat-choking red dust. I'd always wondered how a horse could keep breathing in a dust storm when a human would almost choke to death. Of course, I've long since learned that dust particles inhaled by a horse can cause inflammation of the lungs and even cause death. A little something I learned from my pa, the livery stable owner. I felt a slight twinge in my chest as I thought of pa and all the things that he had taught me. Chapter 13. As we traveled further south, the land seemed to change to a greener look, with more trees and tall grass. The weather also changed. For the better, Orville said, because I like those warm days and cool nights. Almost 3 days later, we came upon a large sign, at least 16 feet in the air, and hanging across the road with big fancy letters burned into it, proclaiming Rancho Valverde. Orville tugged on the reins and brought the wagon to a halt, and we set the brake and scrambled down to the ground. As we looked both to the right and then to the left, there was a shiny barbed wire fence as far as we could see. "Hate barbed wire," Orville said quietly, wiping his forehead and spitting on the ground. "Some guys in my squad got tangled up in some wire back in 63. Tore 'em up real bad. Had no use for it ever since. But we don't have to worry about getting into the wire, 'cause somebody left a big old gate right here for us." Climbed back up on the wagon seat, hollered giddy up, then maneuvered the wagon through that nice gate that somebody had left for us and urged the team to a fast trot. "I heard someplace this was a big spread," exclaimed Orville, "but I had no idea." We'd been traveling almost 2 days and still saw nothing but land and more land. Right before dusk on the second day, I looked at the western sky as it gleamed a deep amethyst against a sunset of crimson, and I watched as golden rays shot straight up into the heavens. In the distance, we saw what looked like the top of a castle shining in the sunlight. As we approached, there were 7 horsemen that came out of nowhere and rode beside us. Their outfits were a fancy Mexican style with lots of decoration and some of the most beautiful mounts I had ever seen. And I'd seen a lot of horses in my few short years in the livery stable with Pa. The silvery full moon was straight in the sky when we arrived at the front door of that castle. We were welcomed by a big brown Mexican named Pancho Luis Alfonso Lizarraga, who said he was the El Patron of the whole rancho, or, as us gringos would say, the foreman of the rancho. "Please allow one of el asistentes to show you the bunkhouse for the night. You will meet El Proprietario tomorrow." That would be the owner. Chapter 14. The bunkhouse was a large adobe building with windows all around the high walls. It was situated on a little rise away from the other buildings so that no matter which way the wind was blowing, there would be a breeze blowing through the bunkhouse. The straw boss assigned us a couple of bunks on the west side of the long room. was just enough moonlight shining through the windows by my bunk that I had to turn away, as the moon was extremely bright tonight. The bunk was a lot more comfortable than where we had been sleeping for the past few nights. Orville took the bunk next to me and was snoring within a few seconds of his head hitting the pillow. How he could sleep with all the noise he was making was beyond belief. I guess I found out how he did it, because the next thing I knew, the sun was shining through my window and waking me up with its brightness. I sat in the side of the bed and said quietly, "Orville, wake up." He sat straight up in his bunk and exclaimed, "Where are we? Is the Rebs coming over the hill?" "It's all right, Orville. We're here at the horse ranch. You can wake up now." As we dressed, we looked around at all the empty bunks and realized that it was well past time for all of the vaqueros to be out in the range. We stepped outside looking for a place to relieve ourselves, and when the straw boss walked up and said, "This way, senors. The outhouse is this way, and there is water and towels on the side of the bunkhouse for you to freshen up before you meet El Proprietario. Please to continue up this path to the main door of La Casa." When we had freshened up and changed into the cleanest clothes we had, I brushed off the best I could, and we proceeded up the walk to the main house. We got about 10 feet from the front door, and it slammed open, and a small Mexican man, probably less than 5 feet tall, 110 pounds, and wearing very fancy, colorful clothes, approached us with a big grin on his mustached face. "Hola, hola, amigos. I am called Joaquin Marietta. So happy to have your presence here at our fine hacienda. Please come into my alcomador, or how you say in English, here's some breakfast. But please leave the pistolas on the porch before you enter. Gracias, senor." Orville, still at his cavalry-issued, single-action, Colt Model 1847, 44-caliber ball-and-cap revolver, and the army-issued holster with a snap-down flap. We removed our gun belts and placed them on a bench on the porch beside the door. "You have been to a beautiful country before, yes? I noticed the gaucho saddle on the pretty mare." As we walked through the door, the smells attacked my palate with a vengeance. "Please be seated, senor. I will call for El Mayordomo to serve you. After you have eaten, we will meet in El Salon, share some brandy, and discuss what brings you here in the south of Texas and north of Mexico." Chapter 15. The meal was fit for a king, and I suspect that's exactly how the owner of this beautiful place pictured himself. There were fresh oranges, pineapples, peaches, and all sorts of delicious fruit. Then there were scrambled eggs with sausage. Wrapped inside that was delicious hot cakes and fried potatoes. There was fresh milk, fresh squeezed orange juice, and fresh churned butter to spread on the thickly sliced bread, as well as many other things that I didn't know what they were. When we were finished eating, the butler led us to the living room, where Joaquin Marietta was seated on the big fancy armchair that looked like a throne. "Please, senor, have a seat, and El Mayordomo will pour you the brandy. It is one of the finest blends in all the USA, imported from Weisenstein Winery in Wisconsin. They have some of the finest wines, but this brandy is almost as good as the Spanish brandy of my ancestors. Please taste and let me know if I am right." I'd never tasted hard liquor of any kind, but I didn't feel that I could refuse our benefactor's hospitality. I reached, took the glass, and then Orville did the same. Orville turned the glass up and chug-a-lugged the liquid down in one swallow. Marietta exclaimed, "Senor, have you never drank brandy before? You do not drink it straight down. You sip it very slowly so as to enjoy the fine taste. Please, pour another." I was still holding the glass and feeling like I didn't want to try it when Marietta asked, "You have never had brandy before, no?" "That's right," I said. "I haven't ever had any kind of spirits before, and I don't mean to insult you, but I would prefer something a little easier on the palate." "Of course, senor, I am so sorry. Perhaps a little grape juice would be more to your pleasure. It is made from grapes that we grow right here in our ranchero." Marietta called for the butler to bring out a bottle of grape juice. He returned with a large bottle and poured me half a glass. It must have been stored in the cellar because it was cool and sweet to the taste. "Thank you so much for understanding," I said. "Now, let's discuss why you have come to our rancho." "Now, we want to trade 2 horses for 1 for my friend," I told him. "I would be willing to trade 1 good horse for all 3 of your horses, only because I am, how you say, I am partial to the colorful leopard spotted mare." I was quick to inform him that sugar was not for trade or sale. "That is fine, but I would not be wanting to trade for the 2 broken-down mares without her." "Then we want to purchase a good horse for my friend. Oh, certainly. I will show you the ones I have for sale myself. If you will please follow me, senors. Chapter 16. We walked for what seemed a mile and came to a big horse barn that was as big as a town. There was a large corral to the side of the barn, and there were a dozen vaqueros standing around the corral watching one young vaquero bouncing on top of a mount. It was a chestnut-colored Arabian horse standing around 14 to 15 hands high. I could almost feel my bones jarring each time that horse came down on all 4 feet. That young man was holding on, but it looked as though he was getting tired. With one last whirl and a short jump, the horse began prancing around the corral. Applause broke out from all around the corral as men were calling out the youngster's name. Heredo! Heredo! His full name, as I learned later, was Heredo Sebastiano Julian Fermin Tabadas, and he had just celebrated his 18th birthday a week ago. The horse was a present from El Tio, his uncle, Joaquin Marietta, to whom we were guests. His uncle has told him that he would give him the horse if he could ride him. He didn't, however, tell him that the horse had never been ridden. Took him 5 tries, but on the 6th his luck had changed, or as he put it, the horse got tired of him punching him with those spurs. After his uncle gave his congratulations to the young man, we continued a little further to the next big corral. There were a dozen or more horses inside. These horses are some of the finest in Mexico, and would make a fine mount, said our host. There were 6 grade horses of various colored coats. Grade horses, even though they didn't have a distinguishing pedigree, could do everything any other horse could do, and many make ideal beginner horses. There were 2 big black Morgans, one a pinto, and the other a solid brown, both at about 15 hands high. Tennessee Walker, that was silver, dapple in color, and was about the size as the others, and a Kentucky Mountain saddle horse, Palomino. Orville left the inspecting of the horses to me because of my experience in the livery stable. Orville, I know your heart's set on a Morgan, I said, but I don't think we should leave your buckboard here, even though it's worn out. It can still carry all your stuff. I feel that Palomino would be the best horse for you, because not only a good saddle horse, but he can pull a wagon, too. Marietta said, Ah, a fine piece of horse flesh. And since you are such good amigos of mine, I will take your 2 worn-out mares in trade and let you have the Palomino for $150 US, or 1,000 pesos. Orville said, well, I don't have that much. I will still trade for the pretty colored mare, and even trade, said Marietta. Perhaps you will be my guest for a couple of days and think it over. Maybe you will change your mind. Please, come now. It's almost time for dinner. My niece and nephew will be joining us. Chapter 17. We stopped by the bunkhouse to wash up, then proceeded to the main house, where again we were greeted by the butler, who said, Please follow me, and led us into the dining room where Marietta, the young man from the corral, and a very, very pretty girl were seated at the big table. Please take a seat, and we will begin. This is my nephew, Heredo, and his little sister, Marcela Lupe Esperanza Tabares, the children of my sister, Senora Tabares, who resides in Mexico. They are visiting for Jofa's birthday and receiving his presents from me, the beautiful Arabian stallion that just became his today by taming him for the saddle. Once more, congratulations, Alfado, and happy birthday. The meal was roasted pig with fresh vegetables of all sorts, and lemonade to drink, or wine if you preferred. I had a hard time concentrating on the meal because of Marcela Lupe. She was seated directly across from me. She was a slight, delicate girl, with big, almond-shaped, sepia-brown eyes and waist-length raven-black hair pulled into a bun to the back of her head. Her skin had an olive tint that looked extra smooth and would be great to touch. Her lips were colored a deep, dark red, and I wondered if they were as soft and sweet as Penelope's lips. Marietta and Orville kept the conversation going, each trying to outdo each other with their exploits. Both Afado and Marcela Lupe were very quiet. I did, however, spot Marcela looking my way on more than one occasion. We retired to the living room after dinner for a drink, of which I again abstained, and asked to be excused that I might explore the rancho. "Perhaps Afado would show me around," I asked. "That is an excellent idea," exclaimed Marietta. "Maybe you could ask Marcela Lupe to accompany you. You young people should get acquainted." Afato and Marcella joined me outside, and we headed for the corral where the horses were. Afato was very excited to show me his new horse, and I said I was proud of him because he was a very fine mount and would serve him very well in the years to come. I asked Marcella Lupe if she owned a horse. She said, "No, my uncle says women should ride in carriages, not in horses." "Where I come from in Texas," I said, "all the women ride horses and ride in carriages, too." "Please tell me about where you come from and why you were here," she asked. I explained as best I could about Angel Falls, about my pa, and how I came to be on the run from the law, and how Orville and me had come here to buy him a horse. But it looked as though we were not going to be able to do that because our uncle wanted too much money for his horses. "Perhaps we can make a deal between the two of us," said Hofato. "I want to travel and get to know the country, so maybe if I could talk my uncle into selling the horse you want cheaper, you would allow me to accompany you and your friend when you leave this place." "What would your uncle say about you leaving?" I asked. "Would he allow you to leave without returning to your mother?" "I am now 18 years old and free to make my own decisions. How about it? Do we have an understanding?" he exclaimed. "Sounds all right to me, but I'd want to check with Orville before I decide." Afato said, "I will go now and talk to my uncle. You and Marcella Lupe continue on your way and look over the ranchero." Marcella looked at me and said, "If I were still in Mexico, I could not be alone with a boy without a chaperone. Right at this moment, I am very glad not to be in Mexico. How do you feel about that, senora?" And she batted her eyelashes at me. I told her I was extremely glad she was not in Mexico. "I will be 17 in just a few months, and I have never been kissed by a boy. How would you like to be the first boy I have kissed?" "Well, I think that'd be about the greatest thing that ever happened to me in a very long time," I said. Her lips were just as soft as Penelope's lips, but somehow it just didn't make me feel the same as when I kissed Penelope. Maybe it was because I was in love with Penelope and didn't really know Marcella Lupe very well. It was, however, still very exciting and just a little bit scary because I didn't know if someone had seen us kissing. I suggested that we return to the main house before someone did see us. We spent a little time with one another each day that Orville and me stayed at the ranchero, and yes, I did sample her lips a few more times, but as I said, my heart belonged to someone else back in Angel Falls. Chapter 18. When we returned to the main house, Orville and Marietta were still enjoying that bottle of brandy, and both were feeling pretty good. Afato said his uncle, since he was in such a good mood from all the drinking, had agreed to let us have the Palomino horse for $50 US, and the two brindle mares. I told him that sounded great and that he needed to pack his things and say his goodbyes because we'd be pulling out at first light. The next morning, the South Texas sun was bright, and yet the breeze that rippled around the corner of the big house was cool, hinting at a chance of rain. Orville had his new Palomino hooked to the buckboard and was raring to go before it started raining. Leaned forward on the hard seat, squinting into the incandescent sunrise, he removed his old slouch hat, wiped his brow, then put his hat back on his head, wrapped the reins around his fist, and said, "Giddy up," and headed towards that big, fancy gate. Afido mounted his Arabian after saying his goodbyes to his uncle and sister, and headed out behind Orville. I shook Marietta's hand, told him how pleased I was to have met him, and not to worry about his nephew, as Orville and I would both be looking out for him. Then I turned to face Marcella Lupe, looked at her in the eye, and said that she had been the most enjoyable part of my stay here at the rancho. She reached up, kissed me on the cheek, and said quietly, "Please think about me." Then a single silver tear shimmered down her cheek. "Return, if you can." I reached and wiped the tear with the back of my hand, smiled, then turned and mounted Sugar with a little feeling of regret mingled with relief. Regret that I wasn't staying with Marcella Lupe, and relief that I was moving on. I waved and turned Sugar to follow after my two partners. Chapter 19. We headed north back to Angel Falls where I had left. I needed to see where they had buried Pa and check on things. We traveled a bit more to the east, hoping to hit a small settlement where we could get some supplies. We might also have to try to find some kind of work because we were running low on funds. What I didn't know at the time was that Afido had plenty of money that had been given to him by his mother and other kin for his birthday. We arrived just before midnight in a little settlement called Buffalo Mills. It had only a trading post, a saloon, and a few other buildings. There were two teepees and three ramshackled clapboard buildings surrounding the two main structures, and between the trading post and the saloon was a corral with four horses in it, bedded down next to the wagon just on the outskirts of the booming metropolis. As the sun was rising, it created an eerie shadow through several blackberry bushes picked clean by the birds of the area. Orville suggested that we try to locate something to eat in the settlement, so we mounted up and headed in that direction. We rode up to the front of the trading post, and the sign read, "Trader Tom's Trading Post." We dismounted, went inside. The man inside could have been an Indian, the way he looked and dressed. He was wearing buckskin trousers with a jacket and lots of beads and bones all around the edges. He wore a top hat that was worn down on one side and couldn't be defined as a top hat anymore. Probably weighed 250 pounds, stood 6 feet tall, and had a face full of bushy hair. His nose was very big and very red, and he spoke with a brogue that I couldn't quite place. "Can I do for you, lads? Do you have any grub, or do you know where we might get some breakfast? Don't have any fresh fixin's here, but the saloon next door'll serve you pretty good victuals," he said. "We'll be back for supplies when we've had our fill," I said. And we left the trading post, stepped up onto the boardwalk, and entered the swinging doors of the saloon. I squinted as I entered, shifting to the right and letting my eyes adjust to the semi-darkness of the room. There was a long, rough-hewn log set up for a bar with four homemade wooden tables and four wooden chairs for each table. There was a short, roly-poly Indian woman with a pudgy face, her hair pulled back into a single ponytail, the way a lot of Indian women wear their hair. She had rust-colored skin and obsidian eyes that cut right through a person and seemed to read their every thought. She was wearing a dress that was made from a big horn sheepskin that hadn't been washed recently, and she was sitting at one of the tables close to the bar. A rotund, bald, elderly gentleman, probably 400 pounds, who was hunched over the bar as if it was keeping him from tipping over onto the floor, was wiping the counter with a dirty rag. "What'll it be, gentlemen?" he asked. "Sadie can go in the back with you, if you've a mind to, or she can fix some victuals for you. Or I can pour you some rot-gut whiskey. I have a warm beer for the young lads if they don't want hard liquor." Saloons served beer, but back in those days the beer was never ice-cold. Usually served at 55 to 65 degrees, you had to drink it in a hurry before it got too warm or flat. "Like I said, what'll it be?" "Well, we'd like something to eat, if it's any good," I replied. "Been eating her cookin' nigh on 7 years. Ain't hurt me none. Take a look-see for yourself." He grinned through dirty teeth. "We'll take whatever the special of the day is, and bring me a whiskey and 2 glasses of sweet cider for these young pups," said Orville. Rutgut was often 100 proof, though it was sometimes cut by the barkeep with turpentine, ammonia, gunpowder, or cayenne pepper. "Sure thing. Sadie, warm up that antelope stew that's back there in the stove, and tote this whiskey and cider to the gentleman," he ordered. Soon as Sadie brought the drinks to the table, she hobbled off through a dirty curtain and disappeared from sight. Wasn't long till we heard the most awful banging, some cursing, and then Sadie magically appeared through the curtain carrying 3 tin plates heaping with stew and a loaf of brown, moldy bread. Tried not to look her in the eye as her pudgy fingers placed the 10 plates on the table. Then she returned to her chair at the end of the bar. "Dig in, gentlemen," said the barkeep. "Tastes better than it looks." "Well, I've ate worse than this on the battlefield many times, and I survived," Orville said with a sick look. "Let's dig in." The first spoonful was really slow getting to my mouth, but as soon as it passed over my tongue, I began gobbling it down. I hadn't tasted anything this good in a very long time. Even the feast we had at Señor Marietta's rancho didn't compare. Orville asked for a second helping, and Sadie hobbled off to get it. While he finished off his second helping, he made a suggestion. "How about we change Alfado's name to Half-Loaf? Be a heck of a lot easier to remember." Alfado nodded and said, "I think that is a good American name. I will carry it proudly. I will be called Half-Loaf from this moment on." "Thank you, Señor Orville." "Oh, just call me Orville, if you please, Half-Loaf." Then we left and went next door to buy supplies. Chapter 20. We stepped into the trading post and perused the merchandise. I told Orville that he should choose the items that we would need for our trip, and he gave Trader Tom a list of things we needed, which consisted of 20 pounds of breadstuff, flours and crackers, 10 pounds of bacon, 6 pounds of coffee, 6 pounds of sugar, 10 pounds of rice, 2 bushels of beans, 2 bushels of dried fruit, 4 front button flannel overshirts, 6 wool undershirts, 6 pair of thick cotton drawers, 6 pair of wool socks, 6 pair of cotton socks, 3 ponchos, 3 coats, and overcoats, plus stout linen thread, large needles, beeswax, a few buttons, paper of pins, and a thimble, with all the sewing products in a small cloth bag. When he had it all stacked on the counter, Trader Tom added it up, and we found we didn't have enough to pay for it. "Is there anybody needs some chores done so we can earn enough to pay for this?" asked Orville. "You know, that's quite odd that you should ask," said the storekeep, "because the old man who's been supplying our wood was buried just 3 days ago, and we're needing some wood chopped. Probably 4 cords would just about pay for your goods." "Where's the wood, and where would you be wanting it stacked?" I asked. 2 cords behind the saloon, and 2 cords behind the trading post," he answered. Orville said, "Well, I only got 1 axe. Would you happen to have another? Just help yourself to one of the new ones back yonder. When you're done chopping, add it to your goods," said Tom the storekeep. Chapter 21. There were a lot of dead trees in a washed-out gully about 1.5 miles behind the saloon. We loaded all of the chopped wood into the buckboard and carried it right up to the buildings. While Orville and me chopped, Half Loaf carried and stacked the wood in the appointed places. "I sure wish I'd brought my crossbow saw," said Orville. "Would make this job a lot easier." A cord of wood measures 4 feet by 4 feet by 8 feet long, and it took us a full day and a half to complete the task. Orville and me were in fair shape from all the work we had done back at his farm, but Half Loaf wasn't used to that kind of manual labor at all. I will say this for him, he didn't slow down or complain at all. I do wish we had gotten him a pair of gloves, because he had broken blisters on both his hands. Orville put some horse liniment on them, and in a couple of days they were looking a lot better. We had eaten at the saloon while we were there, and I swear that antelope stew got better each time we ate it. When we had loaded all the supplies that we had chopped wood for, Orville said, "Wait just a minute," and we went back to the trading post, and he asked Tom how much more wood he wanted for the saddle he had stored in the back room. "I may want to get rid of that rickety buckboard and ride like a real soldier." Half Loaf and me, well, we followed Orville back inside. When Tom and Orville reached an agreement for the saddle, Half Loaf asked Tom if he had any pistols. "I have one of the finest pistols in this here country," he said. "Traded it from a gambler who was down on his luck when he passed through here on his way to better things." He reached down under the counter and pulled out a little pearl-handled 36 caliber revolver that had about a 4-inch barrel. "What do you think of this?" Tom asked. "It is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen," said Half Loaf. "It is indeed the finest of the finest. I must own this beautiful weapon." Tom said he also had the holster that came with it, but he didn't understand how it worked. He said the gambler showed him how, but he forgot. "It's called a shoulder holster, and it fit under your arm somehow." It was then that I learned Half Loaf had money that he had received for his birthday. However, most of it was pesos, and pesos aren't worth as much as U.S. dollars. Half Loaf and Tom agreed on a price for the pistol and the holster. Half Loaf said, "I would also like to pay for the saddle." Half Loaf settled with Tom, and then Orville loaded the saddle and the buckboard, and we headed out towards the northeast. Chapter 22. A little after dusk, the wind changed direction, and it looked like a sudden rain shower was coming on this dusty, dry summer day. Stars like little pinpricks sprinkled the heavens, and the softest whisper of wind blew across my body. The steady patter of raindrops came scattering down on my hat as I pulled the new slicker which I had gotten at the trading post over my head. As the rain pelted down, the faintest purple haze of moonlight hovered over the vast countryside, and it was a beautiful sight to see. We had also bought a tent, and we stopped to set it up and get out of the rain, as it looked like it was going to last all night. There was a grove of live oak trees next to where we set up the tent, and there was a big one with overhanging branches that would shelter the horses. It also gave enough shelter for a small campfire to heat some of Orville's famous coffee. After we drank a couple of cups, we bedded down inside the tent. The next morning, after a cup of coffee, we packed our gear and headed out. About 2 hours later, we spotted three riders in the distance riding towards us. Orville reached down, placed his carbine across his lap. I told Half-Loaf that if there was any shooting, to slide off his horse, lie face down on the ground. Orville removed his pistol from the army holster and laid it beside him on the seat. I dismounted, stepped forward, took a stance facing the men as they approached. I slipped the leather tie off the hammer, making it ready to be drawn. I heard Orville cock his rifle as he cleared his throat. Chapter 23. All three men were wearing dusters and sporting tied-down holsters, which meant only one thing. They were up to no good. They stopped about 10 feet in front of us. The taller one, to the left of the group, stepped down off his mount. He was probably 6'2", 180 pounds, and 30 to 35 years old, with sandy or red hair that had a little gray in it, and a sandy beard and mustache. His chin beard was quite long. He had a red or florid complexion, blue eyes, and a full round face that got very red when he raised his voice. His voice carried a strong flavor of the Deep South. The tiny smile lifted one side of his mouth, turning it into a sneer. "Where's your ma and pa? They know you're out this far from home with a Mexican and an old bald-headed man? You know I don't like old bald-headed men. I sure as hell don't like Mexicans." I felt the heat rise in my face. My fists trembled as a dark cloud moved across my face. I let out a long breath and winced at a searing glut of pain lodged in my throat as I thought of Pa. Bowed my head as something inside gave way to a sickening realization that I would never see my Pa again this side of heaven. And then something Pa had said one time came to mind. "Our lives are like water poured on the ground. It can't be gathered up again." A trickle of sweat inched down my neck as I looked back at the desperados and said in a quiet voice, "These gentlemen are my family, and I don't take kindly to anyone insulting them like that." Sheer will and desperation at having nowhere to turn made me stand my ground and face the outlaws. "You got in that wagon? You got anything a mock could use? Maybe I'll just have me a look and see." "Probably be healthier for you if you didn't do that," I said. "You figure on stopping me, kid? Don't really cotton to being called kid, and yes, if I have to, I will stop you," I said. I took a look at the mounted men. There was one mulatto with a gunpowder burn on his cheek. He looked to be close to 50 years old, with a long gray streaked beard and dark brooding eyes. The other was tall, thin, with light hair, a small mustache, hawk nose, and wore a rakish look and a bowler. Both men were average height and weight. The mulatto was wearing a large sombrero. The tall man noticed me looking at his compadres and said, "The white nigger's called Blackface Charlie, and the big-nosed Swede is called Big-Nosed George, and they're mean and rearing to back my play," he said. His blue eyes turned nearly black with intensity, and in them welled up an anger and a hatred swift, deep, and complete. Seemed the chances of reaching some kind of understanding had come to an end. I sidestepped to the right as I drew my pistol and shot the tall man in the forehead before his gun cleared the holster. He crumpled to the ground without a sound, and I fell to the ground as the bullet whizzed by my head, and I shot the mulatto out of the saddle, and he fell to the dusty ground. Orville had shot Big Nose George in the neck with his rifle, and George died in the dust about 10 feet away as his horse ran from the noise. It seemed that all that practicing I had done out behind the barn all those times paid off in dividends. In the hush of the moment, a breeze tickled a hair on the back of my neck, and I realized that no matter where I went from this moment on, one thing was certain. My life had just changed. I was headed down a path that I was not completely satisfied with, but I was determined that, in spite of what had just transpired, I would try to live my life in a way that would last and count for something, just like Pastor Colson had told me God would want me to do. Orville, Half-Loaf, and me gathered the outlaws' horses and unsaddled them. Then we loaded the saddles into the buckboard. We also removed their holsters and pistols and put them in the wagon. We loaded their bodies in the wagon and turned towards the little grove of cottonwood trees off to the east and dug one big grave for the three of them. Bowed my head, said a prayer for the men, asking God to remember the good things that they might have done, and let the bad slide. Then I asked for forgiveness for us taking the lives of these men, and prayed that this was not going to be a reoccurring thing in my life. Orville said justice had been served. If we hadn't killed them, They would have hanged one day anyhow, he said. We tied the extra mounts behind the wagon, mounted up, and continued our trek to the northeast. Chapter 24. As we traveled closer to Angel Falls, I felt reluctant to simply ride into town down Main Street because, well, I didn't know if the sheriff might have second thoughts about wanting me dead after he realized the circumstances surrounding the shooting of his brother. Well, I suggested that Orville and Halfloaf go ahead to the livery stable and board the horses. I would go around the back way, come up the side street to the pastor's house. As I rode down the side street, I spotted the old peddler that I had talked to many times, pulling his rickety cart behind him and speaking to each person he passed, whether they acknowledged him or not. When he spotted me, a smile creased the lines of his sun-furrowed, bearded face, and he showed that toothless grin of his. He looked as if he hadn't eaten a good meal in days, even weeks. He exclaimed, "It's good to see you, Jed, boy. Where you been? Did you hear about your paw?" I stepped off Sugar, clasped the old man's grimy hand, and said, "Good to see you too, old-timer. And yes, I do know about my paw. Say, have you had anything to eat today?"
"Had a little bit of stuff I found behind Myrtle's."
"Why don't you take this dollar and go get something that'll fill you up?" And I handed him a silver dollar.
"Well, thank you, Jed. I appreciate it so much. But God bless you and keep you."
I mounted Sugar and continued on to the Parson's house on 3rd Street. When I got to the corner, I turned in the saddle and looked at the old man, and the sight created a lasting picture in my mind of an aged hawker with his feeble hand raised in a parting gesture, baggy clothes hanging from his frail body, reeking from having gone too long unwashed, and the smile the man wore, even with so little in his possession. I touched the brim of my hat and watched the old man's face light up. It made me realize that possessions were not all they were stacked up to be. I rode Sugar up to the back fence of the pastor's house and climbed down from the saddle. Then I pushed the gate open and walked to the back of the house, stepped up onto the porch, removed my hat, knocked on the screen door. I wiped my sweaty hands on the side of my trousers and waited for someone to answer. Mrs. Colson answered the door, and her eyes grew wide with surprise when she saw it was me. "Jedediah Isaiah Jenkins, my goodness, son, please come inside. Pastor is at the church getting ready for tomorrow's sermon. He'll be so glad to see you. You've been in our prayers every day. Please be seated, and I will get you something to drink." She returned with two tall glasses of apple cider and a large platter of cookies. I had to hold back to keep from grabbing too many because oatmeal cookies were my favorite. I exclaimed, "Well, these are the best oatmeal cookies I've ever had." Just as I polished off another cookie and took a long drink of cider, Pastor Colson walked through the back door, hung his hat in a peg on the side, and looked long and hard at me.
"Looking mighty fine, Brother Jed. Very pleased to see you."
He stepped forward and shook my hand as he clasped my shoulder.
"Terribly sorry about your paw. I know the two of you are very close. I want you to know he had a very nice funeral, and just about everyone in town attending. I'd be pleased to accompany you to the cemetery when you're ready."
"I'm ready any time you are," I replied. "Do you know if the sheriff is still looking for me? If he is, maybe I should take care of that little problem first."
"Well, I think the sheriff's out of town today," the pastor said, "so even if he's looking for you, it won't happen today. Let me get my small traveling Bible, and we'll go."
I thanked Mrs. Colson and told her how much I enjoyed the cookies and cider again, and that I hoped to see her soon, and we left for the cemetery. It was located up on the little knoll by the little church house east of town. There was a slight incline as we got closer to the church. A sudden gust of wind hit me full in the face, nearly causing me to lose my footing on the slope. Pastor Colson reached for me as I stumbled.
"Watch step, Jed. Almost there."
The wind was almost non-existent as we came into the protection of the church building. We walked behind and proceeded to the little cemetery where many good and bad people lay at rest. I followed the pastor to the back of the cemetery where Pa's grave was. There was a rough-fashioned wooden cross on the grave bearing Pa's name. Pastor Colson lay his hand on my shoulder and said quietly, "I'll leave you alone for a while." I removed my hat and knelt on the ground beside the grave that held Pa's body, but I knew that wasn't my Pa in that coffin. He'd already ascended into the heavens to sit with Jesus, the right hand of God. Tears began running down my face as I remembered how much I loved and respected him.
Not only had he been my pa and ma, but he was my friend, and I was going to miss him very much. I raised up, brushed the tears from my face, then put my hat back on my head, and turned to go to Pastor Carlson, who was standing over to the side of the graves. "It was a fine funeral, Jedediah," he said. "What are your plans now? I know you'll want to talk to Mr. Sanders, the lawyer, as I know he has your pa's last will and testament. Well, while the sheriff is out of town, I'd like to go and see Penelope and maybe stop by the livery stable and see how it's doing." "Jed, I'm extremely sorry to tell you this," the pastor said. "Penelope and Jeremy were married just last weekend." My heart seemed to stop beating for a second, and I stumbled to keep my balance. How about the livery stable? Did someone else take it over too?" "No, Hank Crenshaw's been running it day and night. He said he'd run it until you came back to take it over. Blacksmith shop has been closed all these months. As for the farm, your neighbor Homer Kingsaver has been coming each evening and tending the stock." "Maybe I should go talk to Mr. Sanders now," I said. Chapter 25. I headed to Main Street where the lawyer's office was located, and I felt as though a big boulder was on my shoulder as I stepped up on the boardwalk and entered the office. Mr. Sanders was sitting at a desk off to the side of a room behind a little wooden fence. "Can I do for you, young man?" He stood and extended his right hand. "My name's Arthur Sanders. My name's Jedediah Isaiah Jenkins, and my pa was Jeremiah Jenkins. Pastor Colson told me you had his last will and testament." "Yes, yes, of course. Please be seated, and I'll get it." He turned, opened a file cabinet, and took out a large brown envelope with papers inside. "This is it," he said, as he sat behind his desk and opened the envelope. He removed some papers and began to read. "I, Jeremiah Israel Jenkins, being of sound mind and body, do bequeath all my worldly belongings to my only son, Jedediah Isaiah Jenkins." "It looks as if it's very direct and simple. Your father left everything to you. That includes the livery stable, the blacksmith shop, and, of course, the homestead. There's also a substantial amount of money in the bank. That is yours as well. Now here's a copy of the will for you to take with you. If I can be of any more assistance to you, please contact me any time." He stood, handed me the papers, and shook my hand again, and escorted me to the door. My boot heels echoed on the porch steps as I left his office. Then, like a tap on my shoulder, instinct caused a warning bell to sound in my head. I quickly whirled around and spotted a lone gunman on the rooftop of a building across the empty street with a rifle pointed in my direction. I ducked just as a bullet nicked the crown of my Stetson. I drew and shot in one fluid movement, and the fellow tumbled off the roof and landed face down on a dusty street. I replaced the spent cartridge and walked over to where he was lying in the street just as people came running from their hiding places. "That's the sheriff's best friend," exclaimed one of the men, and they all gathered around gawking at the dead man, and then they looked at me. "Say, ain't you the blacksmith's kid?" someone asked. "Yes, I am, and yes, I know the sheriff will be looking for me when he gets back to town," I replied. I walked away from the gathered crowd and headed for the livery stable, where I needed to find my friends and partners and let them know all that had transpired. The bright noonday sun cast my long shadow in front of me, and it looked as though I was chasing myself. I walked south on Main, turned left on Hickory, and headed straight for the livery stable and blacksmith shop. There was Orville's buckboard sitting beside the livery stable. I walked inside, and Orville and Halfloaf were lying in one of the stalls, fast asleep. Hank Crenshaw was sitting on a bag of seeds, leaning back against the wall with his hat pulled low over his eyes, snoring as loud as Orville. I decided not to wake them just then, as I had some more exploring I needed to do. I walked next door to the blacksmith shop, and the door was closed with a sign that read, "Shop closed. In need of a blacksmith. See Henry Plank next door in the telegraph office." Well, I went next door and asked Mr. Plank if he had any folks interested in buying the shop. "Sure is good to see you, Jed." "No, but there was one elderly gentleman that wanted to rent or lease it. You back to stay, son? You know the sheriff's still on the prod for you. It's a good thing for you that he's out of town today." "Has anyone explained to him that I had no choice in killing his brother?" I asked. "He's a very bitter and vindictive man, and he said didn't matter why you shot his brother. Going to get you if it was the last thing he did," said Mr. Plank. "Maybe I can get things settled up and be out of town before he returns. If the man returns wanting to lease the shop, let him have it at a reasonable price. Doesn't look as though I'll be taking it over." walked back to the livery and woke up Orville and Mr. Crenshaw and Halfloaf. Orville said he had made a deal with Mr. Crenshaw to buy the extra saddles and horses that we had. Mr. Crenshaw said, "Well, that was before I knew they were with you, Jed. Seeing as how you're back now, I'll be letting you make the business decisions." "Well, that's all right, Mr. Crenshaw," I said. "I won't be staying. And I would like to make arrangements with you to keep on running the livery stable, if you've a mind to. I will arrange it with the bank for you to deposit the money from the livery and pay you a salary. Mr. Plank next door is seeing to leasing the blacksmith shop to a gentleman who's interested. We do need whatever amount of money you agreed to for the horses and saddles. Orville, why don't you and Halfloaf take the extra outfits over to the mercantile and see what Mr. Salinger is willing to pay for them? He always seemed like a fair businessman. I'm going to the bank, see what they have to say about my pa's account." Chapter 26. Walked into the bank and looked for the manager, who I found at a desk off to one side and behind the counter. Walked up to him and asked, "You got a little time to spare? I need to conduct some business with you." "Of course, you're the Jenkins boy, ain't you? My condolences to you for your loss. I suppose you're here to discuss your father's account, which I suppose, under the circumstances, is your account now. There's an ample amount of funds for you to continue the same line of credit that your father had with us." I said, "I'm not sure what I plan to do right at this moment. I just wanted to check in with you and see if everything was in order." "Quite so, quite so," the banker said. "Will you be needing any funds while you're here?" "No, but thank you for inquiring," I said. "I'll let you know when the circumstances change." We stood, shook hands, then I left the bank and headed back to the livery stable. When I got there, I explained the circumstances of how it happened that I had shot the sheriff's best friend. Orville and Halfloaf both said, "Sure looks like you're not too welcome in this town. Thought you said you grew up here." "Oh, I did, and since you mentioned that, I think I'd like to go check on the home place. Both welcome to tag along if you want to." Well, they both declined, stating that I'd probably want to be alone for a little while. Perhaps they would ride out in a day or two. I looked at them, realizing what true friends they really were at that moment. I climbed into the saddle, waved, and rode out of town towards some of the most pleasant memories of my short life. As Sugar and I approached the house, I noticed that it was in need of some repair. I suppose with nobody living in it, it had gotten kind of run down. In the hush of the moment, a breeze stirred the leaves of the big cottonwoods at the side of the house. I tied Sugar to the hitching rail in front of the house, took a deep breath, and walked inside. Surveyed the room and realized that the last time I was here, Pa had just left for town, and I was getting ready to finish my chores so I could shoot some targets out behind the barn. Walked over to the sink as a warm breeze stirred the lace curtains and filled the kitchen with the sweet blend of honeysuckle and lavender. I breathed in the mingled scents and sighed, remembering the last time I stood in exactly the same spot, looking out across the yard. Then I dropped to my knees and prayed. "Dear Lord, I didn't choose this path that I'm on, but I'm trying to understand why these events are unfolding in my life, and I vow that whatever does happen, I will try my best to do things according to your will. Amen." Chapter 27. I mounted up and rode west about 4 miles to Mr. Kingsaver's place. He was in the corral working on a roan mare. "Welcome, Jed. Climb down. Sorry about your paw. I'm glad to see you back." Slid out of the saddle and accepted his hand, which was calloused and rough, the way a working man's hands should be. "I wanted to thank you for helping out in my absence," I said, "and ask you if you'd be willing to continue, as I'm not sure I'll be able to stay round because the sheriff thinks he has a beef against me, wants to shoot me on sight." "Yes, I heard about that when I was in town. Let me tell you, most of the town folks don't agree with him about that, but he is the sheriff, and you know he rules this town, has it locked up with his cronies calling the shots. How about if I move your stock over here, since you don't have that many? Then I can check in on the house and such every week or so. Be glad to continue, as is, for as long as you need me to." "Thank you so much, Mr. Kingsaver. I will tell all the merchants in town to extend credit to you for any supplies you might need." I extended my hand, and he took it, gripping it solidly. Then he said with a sincere voice, "I am indeed sorry about your pa. He was one of the best friends a man could ask for, and a really good neighbor." I told him I was grateful for his words and his help, then turned, mounted Sugar, and headed back to town. Chapter 28. As I rode into the sunset, the golden rays bathed the brown prairie grass in a reflection of light, causing it to appear as if the ground was glowing from the inside out. It was a beautiful sight, and as always, I was amazed at the wonders of creation that God created. As I rode into town, I was just turning down towards the livery stable when a young lad of about 9 years old with freckles and a big cowlick said, "Pastor Colson wanted me to come to his house at 7 o'clock. I offered him a penny, but he refused, saying Pastor Colson had already paid him. I pulled the pocket watch that my grandpa had given me from my shirt pocket and saw it was almost 7. So I turned and rode towards the pastor's house. I arrived at his home right on time. He said, "Well, let's enjoy a piece of Mrs. Colson's cherry pie, and then we'll discuss why I asked you to come." We were just finishing that big piece of cherry pie with a glass of milk when there was a knock at the door. Pastor Colson got up, answered it, and then said, "Jed, it's for you." I looked up as Penelope stepped through the door with a hangdog expression. I stood politely, turned to face her, and slid my hands into my pockets. "I heard you were back, and I wanted to see you to explain." She looked up at me with those pale blue eyes in her little innocent face. "Please listen and try to understand that I didn't know if you were coming back or not. And then one night, Jeremy and I went a little too far as we were kissing, and the next thing I know, he was asking me to marry him. He's a good husband. He'll be a good father. Please don't be mad at us. We both love you and want to be friends." Her pale blue eyes seemed to change colors as she looked sheepishly at me. I stood there, cocked a single eyebrow at her, and said with an air of confidence, "Oh, I knew all along that you favored him more than me. Why would I be upset with either of you? Congratulations to you, and Jeremy also." My throat seemed to close up on me as I tried to swallow the lump that was there, and I said, "Excuse me, please. I need to get some fresh air." And I stumbled out the door and hurried off the porch and mounted Sugar. The moon seemed to be a shade or two darker in the night sky. I kneed Sugar in the direction of the livery stable. I sure had a lot to share with Orville and Half Loaf. I could only wonder how they were going to react when I told them I would be leaving town as soon as I arranged with the bank and the merchants on how to handle my affairs until I could return. Orville had the tent set up behind the livery stable and had a small fire built with coffee brewing and some beans and bacon in the frying pan, along with some hardtack. "You're just in time," he said. "Grab a plate and a cup. Park yourself over on that bench we borrowed from the stable." I scooped up some beans and bacon onto my plate, grabbed a piece of hardtack, and poured myself a cup of Orville's famous coffee, sat, began eating. No one said anything while we were eating. When we finished, Half Loaf asked, "What are you planning to do now, seeing as how it doesn't seem likely you can stay here? I will travel with you and stand by your side wherever you decide to go." Orville chimed in and exclaimed, "You young pups ain't going to leave me behind. I'm going with you." When the dishes were cleaned and stored in the buckboard, I told them that I'd be going to the bank as soon as it opened in the morning. Chapter 29. The next morning, after we had sausage, biscuits, and gravy, I headed for the bank. As I reached the corner of the building across from the bank, I noticed something out of the corner of my eye that caused me to stand still as a frightened mouse. Across the street and up about a half a block, I saw the sheriff as he stepped out of Myrtle's Cafe. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and placed a toothpick between his whiskered lips. I quickly ducked back into the alley between the buildings where I had been standing. I wasn't quite ready for a showdown with our illustrious sheriff, so I just watched as he continued on to the sheriff's office and jail. When the door closed behind him, I changed directions and worked my way to the back of the livery stable. I quickly told Orville and Half Loaf what had just occurred. I explained that I'd been on my way to the bank and the other merchants in town to arrange for all the people who were going to be taking care of my business and the farm to be properly compensated. As soon as I had completed those things, I was planning on coming back and the three of us riding out. But I saw the sheriff, and I didn't feel like facing him now, so I came back here. Now it looks as though we're going to have to leave sooner than I figured. Orville said he had no problem with that. He'd been packed since our last meal. Half-Loaf said he was ready also, and he had saddled Sugar just in case something like this did happen. It was great to have Orville for a partner, because while I was running around taking care of things, he had replenished our supplies and also had some special things that I was going to enjoy later. He'd been a mess sergeant in the Union Army, so he knew how to order supplies and cook great meals. We headed out to, well, wasn't quite sure. My short-term plans were to stop at the next town that had a telegram and send instructions to all the parties that would be handling my affairs. Anything other than that would have to be worked out between the three of us. I asked, "You fellas remember when we talked about my pa's brothers, how they split up and went in different directions? I was thinking, since we can't stay in this area, how about let's go visit my Uncle James in Velvet Sky, Arizona? Supposed to have a big cattle ranch there in the foothills of the mountains. What do you think? Want to go?" "Sounds like a good idea. I'm ready to go. Are you ready, Half-Loaf?" said Orville. "See, I am ready also." And after checking the cinch and Sugar saddle, I mounted and proclaimed, "Well, I'm ready. Let's ride. Let's go to Velvet Sky, Arizona." You're invited to take just a moment and preview the second in the Traveler series, Velvet Sky, Arizona, The Traveler, number 2, written by J.C. Halsey. Orville, Half-Loaf, and myself were on our way to Velvet Sky, Arizona territories. We decided to go there when I remembered Pa telling me that he had a younger brother living there. Said there were 4 brothers that came by wagon train from Chicago, ranging from 17 to 20 in age. They were of Irish descent. Their ma and pa had passed on, and there was nothing to keep them in Chicago. My pa, being the oldest, was supposed to make the decisions for them. James Seamus was the second born, then Francis Leroy and Justin Lucas was the youngest. When they passed through the Texas Panhandle, they decided to part ways because of the tension that was building between them. They weren't happy with the decisions Pa was making, so Pa decided to head to South Texas, where he heard there was a need for a good blacksmith. They said their goodbyes, and Pa headed south. Then the 3 remaining brothers headed west to California. Pa found out later that James had stopped in a little settlement called Velvet Sky in the Arizona Territories. According to the correspondence he had received, Uncle James had a big cattle spread situated in a valley below the mountain range just east of Velvet Sky. Orville said, "I think we should stop in the next town to get this buckboard checked over and have it repaired, as it's needed for a trip like this, and maybe we should consider getting another horse to help Whitey." That's the Palomino that he had bought from Senor Marietta at his rancho in South Texas. "And pull the wagon. Maybe I'll trade that no-good saddle that I thought I was going to use." He had traded for a saddle when we were at Trader Tom's Trading Post. "That sounds good to me," he said. "How about us finding a spot to camp for the night?" Orville said, "I've always wanted to see how them cowpokes rope those cows and brand them." Half-Loaf said, "I am ready to travel, just to see this beautiful and wonderful country of yours." As I looked at the countryside, I couldn't understand Half-Loaf's description. There were sporadic tufts of trees, on-again, off-again grasses and shrubs, as far as the eye could see. It was a surface that looked as hard as stone, and even less inviting. "I reckon we need to check our supplies and head in that direction," I exclaimed. Suddenly, a windstorm blew up, and dust was everywhere, on the leaves, branches, even my teeth and lips. Then, just as suddenly, it stopped, and in the distance I saw what looked like an oasis, a green strip of thick grass that carpeted the narrow strip along its length. Cottonwood trees had sprung up, young trees, little more than twice a man's height. What a welcome sight after just experiencing a dust storm! I waved to my comrades and pointed to the green strip ahead. We all headed toward it, and the air turned cooler as we got closer. This has been Angel Falls, Texas, The Traveler, The Origin. Written by J.C. Halsey. Narrated by Chaz Allen. Copyright 2014 by J.C. Halsey. Production copyright 2015 by J.C. Halsey.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.